Hi, this is Kirsty Allsop.
And I'm Dr. Sam Godfrey. This is Stand Up to Cancer, the podcast. One in two of us will be diagnosed with cancer. And that's why it's important that we all understand the science of cancer. As they say of all great battles, you must know your enemy before you can defeat them. And that's the aim of this series, to arm and educate us all about the realities of living with and fighting cancer. In this episode, we address the unmet needs in cancer treatment for hard-to-beat areas, such as brain cancer.
So that allows us to distinguish brain that we'd like to leave behind and the patient would like to leave behind even more from the disease that everybody wants us to remove.
This is Stand Up to Cancer, the podcast.
Sam, do you remember when Josh told us all the things he wanted to be when he grew up?
Yeah, it was quite a few.
I would like to be an astronaut, or a fireman, or a police, or a doctor.
What did you want to be when you were 6 years old?
When I was 6 years old, I wrote in class that I wanted to be a saint and I would travel the world, particularly to Ethiopia. My mum would drive me there in the morning and pick me up in the evening and I would feed them on baked beans.
Okie doke. So you and Bob Geldof both.
Yeah, exactly. We're two peas in a pod.
So obviously, for a lot of people, you are now a form of saint because you work in something which worries everybody and you're working towards curing it. So how did you end up in the situation you're in now?
I was always fascinated by like the nuts and bolts of things, what makes things tick, how things work. And so I went to university to do biology because biology was just super cool and really exciting. And I am a bit of a nerd, but I think that's actually a cool thing today, which is even better. And while I was at university, I started to really find that cancer was something which inspired me. It was something which touched so many people. It was something which, yeah, affected everyone. And I thought I'd like to do a PhD in that. And then I went further in my science career. I sort of built up and up and up. And then I got to the point where I am today, where I realised that I actually also really like talking about it, because not every scientist is always fantastic at explaining their research. They may be better scientists than I am, but where I could help is I could explain things to the public. I could help people, and maybe by talking about the research we're doing, we could actually make a difference to people's lives. But it's had more of a personal impact in recent times, in the fact that I've, for the first time, seen someone close to me go through and lose their life to cancer. And that was my grandfather. His name was John, and he was an incredible man. He was one of these people who changed career every 2 or 3 years. He was a fighter pilot, a film editor, bank manager, all sorts of things. But he was also, without doubt, the most brilliant man I've ever known. At the age of 80, he was still writing computer code and stuff. I mean, he was an incredible man. And then he had what he thought was a stroke. He was getting a bit slurry, went to hospital, and they picked up a little shadow on his brain, which initially they thought was the bleed. But then when they did a more in-depth scan, I think it was an MRI, they realised it wasn't a bleed. It was actually a small tumour, and it was growing around the language centre of his brain. And this type of cancer is called glioblastoma. And what that means is it's a cancer of glial cells. And glial cells are kind of like the support network, the things that feed the neurons in your brain. They kind of promote it and help the neurons fire properly. And he had a cancer of this, and it was wrapped around his language centre. And they did an operation, and there was nothing they could do, because he was 80 at this point, and to remove all of that cancer would not only rob him of the ability to speak, but it might not be enough anyway. And so the decision was taken that he would just be given palliative care. And I had to watch as he went from being a fantastically inspirational, funny man that I love beyond anything, and watch as he started to decline, and he suddenly stopped being able to speak, and he started having to use charades, and he gradually lost the use of limbs, and he was in a lot of pain. One of the last moments we had is I tried to feed him some tea through a little sippy cup, and he choked on it, and I said I'd be a lousy nurse, and that made him laugh. And then the last few weeks, he knew my nan was there, and they'd hold hands, but they'd been together since they were 16. And there was nothing that we could do. And I work in an organisation where I see research happening every day. I see the incredible things that are happening. And knowing that there was nothing I could do. There was nothing that any of the people, any of the brilliant scientists I knew could do. And it hurt.
It Is there anyone you work with who you know is working on something which might be able to do something one day for someone in your grandfather's position?
Well, actually, there is. And this is something that when I came into Stand Up to Cancer, which was this year, it was around the time of my grandfather's death, I met this scientist called Dr. Colin Watts.
Hi, my name is Colin. I'm a consultant neurosurgeon based at the University of Cambridge.
And he is working on something extraordinary.
In particular, I'm interested in brain cancer that you see in adults. And my personal research interest is in one type of cancer called glioblastoma. Glioblastoma is the commonest type of cancer. It's also, unfortunately, the most aggressive. And to date, treatments that have been tested haven't worked on it. So one of the things that we're doing is we're trying to improve how we do our surgery. So the treatment for a lot of cancers involves a mixture of surgery, radiotherapy, and chemotherapy. And in patients with brain cancer, generally we start with surgery. The aim of surgery is twofold. It's to take some tissue so we can get a diagnosis, but it's also to try and remove as much of that as we can safely.
Now, about 5% of people survive brain tumours. It's really not good. And part of the problem is that because there's so much essential stuff in the brain, you can't cut out anything extra.
One of the things that we're doing is we're trying to develop techniques that will help us by informing us about what the disease is, how aggressive it's going to be. We need to know that. And we also need to know how far the disease has spread.
So in a breast tumour, you can cut out extra tissue around the cancer to make sure you get every last cell. You can't do that in the brain. And cancer cells are made of the same ingredients as the rest of us. They don't look that different. So for a surgeon trying to chop out all of a tumour, when there's vital bits of brain machinery around it, that's almost impossible. What we need to do is find a way of being able to identify the tumours in the brain, actually be able to see exactly where they are.
It's not like they glow in the dark, really, is it?
Thanks to Stand Up to Cancer Funded research, they actually might.
What, they can inject glow-in-the-dark stuff into cancer so they can see it better?
Kind of, yeah. It's not so far from that. If you look at the brain, you might struggle to see where the tumour is. And even to someone who's highly trained, a specialist like Colin, finding the very edge of the cancer, where it stops, where that last cancer cell is, that can be really hard, which makes it exceptionally difficult to remove every last bit of cancer.
And as you said before, you don't want to take out too much because you haven't got any spare bits of brain.
That's exactly it. With the brain, you want to leave as much intact as possible. Someone might lose the ability to type or to talk or to smell.
That's another reason why we need to know, is it high grade, is it less aggressive? Because the risk-benefit balance changes. And if we can get that information during real time in the OR, then that helps us tailor the surgery to the patient. Number one priority is safety of patient. Number two priority is getting all the tumour out.
But Colin has a trick. When he turns out the lights, he can actually make cancer glow. It's stunning. It's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. You can really see the tumours glowing bright pink. With this technique, surgeons can see right to the edge of the cancer. Potentially, they can remove it with as little effect on the healthy brain as possible, perhaps getting every last cell so the cancer can't come back.
You have to explain how this works.
Well, the script writer wants me to say that the patient's given something like a magic potion, but I'm not going to do that. That would make me shudder to my core as a scientist.
Stick to your guns. What really happens?
Okay, so before surgery, the patient's given this drink, which is made up of a special chemical.
Like a potion.
Like a science potion.
That's not a thing.
Let's let Colin explain.
So the drink is, it's a clear drink, but we call it a pink drink because it causes the tumour to glow pink. They have a drink about 4 hours before surgery. And then what happens is it contains a chemical, if you like, that gets absorbed through the stomach lining, goes into the bloodstream, and is carried along in the bloodstream into the brain, gets out of the blood into the tumour. And for reasons we don't fully understand, causes tumour cells to glow pink under special operating lighting, but the rest of the brain doesn't glow pink. So that allows us to distinguish brain that we'd like to leave behind and the patient would like to leave behind even more from the disease that everybody wants us to remove.
This is medical science at its most exciting. Exactly the sort of thing that Stand Up To Cancer wants to fund as much of as we can. We want to take ideas like this and push them to trials much faster. And if we can do this across the board, we can get more treatments to patients sooner and we can save more lives.
If you're dealing with all of this cutting-edge science, what if an idea doesn't work? It doesn't get to the patients.
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that nothing gets into patients if it isn't safe. But we want to fund things that look like they've got a good chance of working. We want to make sure that we're concentrating on meeting needs that aren't currently being met. And even if something doesn't work, let's say a clinical trial doesn't work how we hope, we've still learnt an awful lot from that. We've still learnt valuable information, which all put together will advance the field of cancer research.
So the first time that I used the fluorescence technique, I thought I'd go for the big bang. So we got a case that was grossly abnormal. And there was a lot of interest, and I had several eminent people sort of stood behind me watching. And I thought, right, I'll go for drama. So I got to the bit of the tumour that looked really nasty, really aggressive. I darkened the theatre and then I flicked the switch, so we went from white light to dark, and nothing. There was no fluorescence, nothing. And I heard this tut behind me. Somebody went, and I thought, right, that's my career over, okay.
It turned out they were looking at a part of the cancer that had already died, which meant there was no bright pink glow. But when he looked in further, he found some active cancer. And I guess that kind of taught them a lesson. That was something that didn't exactly work as they hoped. But since that day, there have been around 250 fluorescent treatments in the UK, and it's helped a lot of people.
And what about those people who take part in the trials, even when there's a possibility that it won't help them?
They're our everyday heroes. The man we heard having that tumour removed by Colin Watts, he's called Christopher. He's 34 years old.
That is really important, is to see if they are able to find new ways of helping people. It would be fantastic just knowing that I could be a little bit part of that to help people.
These are really selfless people.
I have the hugest respect for anyone who's taking part in our trials. They're so important, as are the donations from the public. Today, more than half of people diagnosed with cancer will actually survive for 10 years or more. Many of those will go on to live a long and happy life. That's double what it was 40 years ago. 40 years ago, if you were diagnosed with cancer, you had a 50% chance of being alive 1 year later. So if we don't let up, if we keep on pushing the science, we can make it. Everyone survives.
Next week on Stand Up To Cancer, the podcast,
we turn the spotlight on ourselves, discuss why fundraising and donations are vital in helping us continue our research and achieve our dreams of standing up to cancer.
There is hope and there is reason to be hopeful, but there is also a call to action for the UK, which is get behind these brilliant campaigns and help us raise money that we can then put straight into research and find a cure for cancer.
For too long, cancer's been fighting dirty. It's been targeting grannies, going after kids, and coming back for the same people over and over again, even taking cheap shots at our breasts and testicles. It's got to the point where one in two of us will be diagnosed with cancer, and that totally sucks.
Now is our time to act, to say F that. Time to use whatever means necessary, no matter how ridiculous, to lay the smackdown on cancer.
To help fund the rebellion against cancer, text AUDIO to 70404 right now to give £5 plus one standard message rate. 16 plus only, and you must have the bill payer's permission. It closes on the 31st of March 2017. Full T's and C's are available at sutc.org.uk/terms. 100% of your donation will go to Cancer Research UK in support of the Stand Up To Cancer campaign. Stand Up To Cancer and the Stand Up To Cancer brand marks are registered trademarks or trademarks of the Entertainment Industry Foundation. Cancer Research UK is a registered charity in England and Wales, Scotland, and the Isle of Man.